Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 8. Before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work in Skrepmakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skrepmak people. Every day it becomes clearer that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now, today's guest has had a lifelong and intimate relationship with wild plants and has become known for her expertise in identifying and sharing information about plants in the wild that we can make use of for food and other purposes. Michaela Cannon, expert forager and field botanist, is the author of a new book called Foraging as a Way of Life and has joined us in the studio to share her story and her vast expertise with us. Michaela, welcome very much to our Food Conversations show.
Thank you, Warren. It's nice to be here.
Now, I looked up foraging definition in Wikipedia, and it's described as gathering food from local naturally occurring sources, especially wild edible plants. And that sounds pretty good. But it's also recognized as humanity's oldest and most enduring adaptation to the natural world. And it about 90% of the time that Homo sapiens has been on the planet, that's what we've been doing. And that's about between 200 and 300,000 years. So it's not a new idea, but it is also a profoundly important idea. Now, what is not conveyed by this definition and bit of history is the deep knowledge of nature's complexity that underlies successful foraging. Now, Nancy Turner, who's a famed BC ethnobotanist and who's championed Indigenous knowledge and also who writes the foreword for your book. Your book, again, is a vast array of information about foraging and what it's all about. She outlines the many questions that a successful forager has to ask herself or himself about how to gather wild natural plants successfully. And she lists a whole bunch of questions. Where do they grow? Which are edible? Which are poisonous? Which are usable? What other species are similar and might be mistaken for them? But one that stuck in my mind and stood out, I thought, how can they be harvested sustainably without reducing their populations or impacting other species? Do you want to talk about that a little bit? That seems like an important principle.
Yeah, I think to me, that's the most important principle of all. Before you can harvest anything in, anything, the smallest leaf, I always take a moment to kind of observe the plant and make sure that it's a healthy stand of plant so that it's that I'm not harming, like if I'm picking this plant, will I harm the stand of plants? Will there be less of them? Like when I leave a place, I want to make sure that it looks like I haven't even touched it, and then I feel like that's successful. And I also always want to know if I'm picking something, is it endangered? Is it, is it vulnerable? And leave those be. And it also goes from judging from location to location, because a certain plant might really be abundant in certain areas, but scarce in others. So then it's better just to leave that be. And you can harvest plants in a way that you're not actually damaging them. Like say, for instance, a stinging nettle. If you just harvest the tip of them, the first two nodes, you're actually going to increase the output of that plant. You're not pulling it up by its root. You're not limiting the spread of that plant. You're just kind of pruning it, if you may. So I'm actually working with the plant.
Giving it a haircut.
Yeah, exactly. And then it comes back lusher and greener and it has a longer season. So I do that with stinging nettle and I make sure that I pick them early and then I leave them be a little later on because then this butterfly and the larvae needs to eat it. And then, and then after that they flower and then it's not time to eat them because you need to know when you can eat them.
That's the last question that Nancy Turner puts down is what insects and animals are they associated with? And that's just what you were describing. Now, Nancy Turner also makes note of the fact that in your book, your work is based on meticulous research, and most importantly, your own experiences, and which she associates with what she calls your compelling personal journey. Now we're going to talk about your compelling personal journey because it is really quite compelling. It's different from a lot of people, but it's also like what a lot of people would probably which they'd done at one point or another. Now, in your blog last December, you wrote that there's a law in Sweden, the country where you were born, called Allemansrätten. Allemansrätten.
Nicely pronounced.
Which is close. I mangled a little bit, but not totally. Which translates to every man's right or right of public access, but which is interpreted as basically a right to roam. Mm. But it's not just a right to roam. It's also got responsibilities. Why don't you just talk about that law, which is part of all Scandinavian countries as well?
Yeah, so it was started when there was people who were farmers and they had like a main farmer that they would pay to. Like they didn't have their own land. So they would farm and then almost everything they had to give it up to like the big, you know, the big farmers. So people were literally starving. And like they didn't, like the peasants, they couldn't like really make ends meet. So this law came into effect, Allemansrätten, that people could go out and pick berries. They could get like the sphagnum moss, and they could, you know, like they would have like a, you know, they could get resources that they needed.
A little wildcrafting.
Yeah, exactly. And they could get the birch bark for baskets and things that they needed. And then it's been since just incorporated into like the public soul of Sweden. I can't really speak for the other countries, but for Sweden, yes, definitely. So what it means is that I can walk from the south to the north of Sweden. I can walk through other people's properties as long as I'm not harming anything.
And so I leave 70 meters away from a recognizable dwelling.
So I have to stay away from people's homes and home sites. But I can walk through someone's forest. And if I find a gate and it's closed, I can open it as long as I close it behind me and make sure that it's exactly how I found it. Mm. If I find garbage, I pick it up and dispose of it properly. If I find injured animals, I report that. If I find anything else, you know, pollution, anything that happens, you know, it's my job, it's my responsibility to address that. And then I can pick and harvest.
Well, it would seem in a way that you were born in the right country for your own aspirations. Because with this law, which I'm sure you would have grown up knowing about, it would be something everybody in Sweden knows about. But as a very young child, you reached out to plants. Plants became an important, they became companions for you, more than just, you know, objects of nature. Mm-hmm. Do you remember how old you were when you, or does your mother tell you how old you were when you first went out to look into the natural world, the wonders?
Actually, the first memory I have, like the very first memory, I don't have a lot of memories from when I was very little, but my very first memory is me sitting in some sort of chair or stroller, and someone passing me these cherries, and like me getting to hold this berry and these leaves, and like putting it in my mouth, and just like, you know, the world just opened up. I was just like, oh my goodness, this is just.
You were in a stroller, so you weren't.
I was probably two.
Yes.
Like very little, and this is like my first memory. I could be, like less than two, I would imagine. Yeah.
How did your mother react to you putting the cherries in your mouth? Did she?
Well,
that,
those ones I think someone was feeding me because those were
it was safe.
Those ones were, but yeah. After that, there were times when I would. I actually have this memory from when I was in daycare, and I knew there was a bush at the end of the kind of like courtyard where we were allowed to roam and play in, and it had really tasty leaves. And I knew I would go sit under there. The kids.
You knew it had tasty leaves?
Yeah, because I tasted them. So I would sit under it and I would eat these leaves, and then. Then one day, like, I think we were walking past this plant and someone was pointing it out and said, oh, that one's poisonous. And I thought to myself, no, it's not. I've eaten it. I'm fine.
Well, that must have been a very unusual experience. Here's somebody, well, this is an adult who
pointed
it out, right?
Yeah, who said, oh, don't touch that one. That one's poisonous.
My goodness.
No, it's not. But yes, I mean, there's definitely, you know, I don't recommend it on my classes when people come to my classes. And I don't say to people, just go out and willy-nilly try things.
You don't tell the secret you have that you went out in the woods and you tried things because you had a feeling, and this I think is quite important, you had a feeling that was not necessarily spoken, you just sensed that the plant was okay to eat.
Well, since I also feel it's a huge responsibility to share with people, like, how to be safe foraging?
Well, we'll say don't. If you're listening to this show, do not start doing this, folks. Do not wander out in the woods and just grab a leaf off a plant and start eating it. But this is somewhat this is sort of magical in a way, because you knew something inside, you knew that it was okay. And as you confessed to me very openly, you said, "I never poisoned myself when I was a child."
No, I didn't.
Which is interesting. Well, but it's also interesting that you didn't end up eating anything that was toxic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know why that didn't happen. I mean, since I've become an adult, there are times when I have slightly been in danger of poisoning myself.
Yes. Well, that's good to know that even somebody who's as expert as you are can sometimes make a little mistake. Because I know one of the concerns that many people have is, say, with mushrooms, that they look like each other, and it's the wrong one. Mm-hmm. So here you are. You're a child. You're wandering around. Your mother knew you were out there, and you were out with your sister. Mm-hmm. Your sister, is she older or younger?
She's younger.
She's younger. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what was your mother? She was concerned, but also she was okay with it in a way.
I thought, I think it's really cool that since having my own children, I've realized just like how much trust you have to give your kids in order to just let them roam. We were living in there was just forest, there was not really any other houses other than us. It was our little summer house and then nothing else apart from cow fields and forest. My sister and I would go out in the morning. Sometimes we'd pack a little snack, and then we would be out all day until we would be hungry in the evening, and then we'd come back. And there were times when they didn't really know where we were, But I think it shows a great deal of respect and trust in your children to allow them to go roaming, and it also shows that you trust them to be able and capable. And I think that is a great gift.
Mm-hmm. And it is.
And it's something that I have to learn to do with my kids as well, because it's terrifying as a parent to I have a very vivid imagination, and my mom also has a very vivid imagination. You can conjure up all kinds of horrible things that could happen to your kids.
Did your mother ever tell you that she was sitting there biting her nails wondering what was going on?
Yeah, sometimes I'd come home and she'd be like kind of and I'd be like, "What's wrong with you? We were fine," I realize, oh yeah, that's a terrifying feeling.
Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Michaela Cannon, expert forager and field botanist, and the author of Foraging as a Way of Life. Now, you told me that you felt you were really cared for by nature.
Yeah.
Why don't you describe that feeling?
Yeah, I felt that my whole life, and I still feel that every day. I feel like as I go out there and I see these plants who are my friends, I know you by name, I know... you help me with food, you help me with medicine, you help me find rope, you give me art, craft, supplies, everything comes from the nature around me. And I just feel so held by the land. I don't need to worry. I have everything I need.
In Sweden, there's the indigenous culture, is the Sami culture. Did you have a connection then with... Or just a feeling about their culture? Did you have some sense that it was there and they knew and they were there for a long time?
Well, I'm from the southwest of Sweden, so the Sami culture is way north, further north. And it's interesting that you ask that, because I had gone traveling and I had gone to the Grand Canyon, and there was a woman speaking there. She was First Nations, and I don't know exactly what First Nation she was. But I asked her, "Oh, I'm so curious about your culture. I want to know more." And she said, she's like, "Well, what I think you should do," she said, "is not learn about the culture from far away, but learn about the First Nations people in your own country first. And then from there, you're more informed about your own country, and then you can go off." And I thought, wow, I need to know more. So I went back home and I started learning about the Sami. I mean, they're further north from...
Yes.
So it's not the two regions aren't really overlapping, and it's very different climate, different, plants, different way of life.
Whole different ecosystem.
Yeah, but I found it really fascinating just how the Sami people, so I studied them on my own. I did lots of research by myself.
And we'll be talking about research, because it's a big part of your life. The practice that you developed, and I wonder when it started, was to sit with plants. Mm-hmm. When did you start sitting with plants?
Oh, I've done that always.
So, when you first went out into the forest, you would do that.
So what it looks like to me is like if I see a plant and I don't know it, and I'll sit next to it and I will say, "Hi, my name is Michaela, and who are you?" And then I just watch it for a bit, and then I look, is there lots of it, this plant? And if there is lots, then I might take one sample and I will press it at home. But mostly I just start with, I will look at it and I will draw it. Because when you draw it, not because you're a fancy artist or anything, but just because when you're drawing it...
You have to see it clearly.
Yeah, you pay attention to all the little details. Does it have a little fuss? Is it hairy? Does it have, you know, a jagged edge? And that way I will recognize it. And then I'll take photos of it and I'll take like notes, like where did I find it, what time of year. And I like to focus on a plant for a year because then I can see it from when it's a baby to when it's an adult and then at the end of its life.
Through all the seasons.
Exactly. And then because the plant look very different in its all these different stages. Some plants are not even recognizable from when they're babies to when they're older. Like they even lose like the bottom basal leaves.
They do.
So in that way, I get to know the plant really intimately. And then I'll collect information about that plant through other field guides, through, you know, talking with elders, talking with botanists, talking with herbalists, talking with anyone and everyone, and then watching, you know, things on the online. You know, I just go to all different venues that I can find.
And when did this, I mean, obviously this pattern that you're describing now is what you do as an adult. Mm-hmm. But as a child, when did you start just stopping and looking and sitting by a plant? Did you start that?
I don't remember ever not doing it.
Really?
And similarly, like I like observing it and looking at all the details, like that was always like fascinating to me. I can't remember not ever doing it. Like it's.
Did your sister do the same thing?
She was into animals, so she would do the same with animals. So she would sit and watch an animal and sit and observe its behavior for hours and hours and hours just to see what it would do and then record what it would do. So she had a very similar process, but with animals instead of plants.
And did you talk about it? Did you compare notes?
Always. Yeah, she used to work at a zoo, so she would tell me stories about things that happened at the zoo. And some of the stories were just like, they're just such great stories.
Like animal behavior.
Yeah, there was one animal. I have to tell you the story, Warren. There was this seal or sea lion. Was it a sea lion? It must have been a sea lion. It had gotten out. They had a pond or like a water system. Mm. And it had gotten out and it had gone and made its way down into the city. And it had gotten lost, and it was now really kind of stressed out.
Stressed, indeed.
So it was late at night, and this fellow, he was going home from the pub, and he was a little bit tipsy. So he was walking down, and there's this, you know, like sea lion coming behind him. And this fellow, to his credit, he was just like, oh, it seemed friendly. So I stopped to see what he wanted. So he said he stopped, and this sea lion was so happy to see a person. It was so homesick now and wasn't sure where to go. So it came up, and it kind of put its head in his lap. So he's sitting there on the curb with his sea lion and his head in his lap. And then he called the fire department and said, "Hey, I got this sea lion. I'm not sure where to put it. What do I do?" And they said,
"What do you do with a sea lion in the middle of the city?"
And they said, "Well, why don't you just sleep off the alcohol and you'll be fine." They didn't believe him.
I thought he was making
it up. Then he said, "Well, if you open your window," he's sitting outside the fire hall. He said, "Open your curtains. You'll see me on the curb." They opened the curtains, saw him sitting there. And then realized, well, this is probably an escaped animal from the zoo. So they were able to call, you know, my sister and her colleagues, and they were able to come and get this sea lion back. But she would tell me stories like that. And it's just like, they're fantastic, right? It's something out of a fairy tale.
I have a sea lion in my lap. What should I do?
I just think it's great that he stopped. It seemed friendly, you know, like, okay.
Well, why wouldn't he be friendly? He's used to people coming and gawking at him, and there's one right in front of him. Now, your parents separate when you were quite young. Your father's expectations seem to have been a little more mundane. You know, he's worried about work and making a living and that kind of stuff.
I think that's the role of a parent. You have to.
Yeah, the one parent does that, and the other parent says, "This is my wonder child." But what occurred early on in your mind was a sense of purpose. A sense of purpose. Why being here? How would you, you've told me, but in your own words, how would you describe what you feel is a purpose for you?
Right. So my purpose on this planet, and I realize that sometimes people think, oh, that sounds a little like, you know, high.
Prideful.
Yeah, exactly. But I think if we all found our like purpose on this planet, we'd all be much happier, and it would be a much better place to be on, because we would just do what we want to do instead of, you know, begrudgingly do something else. But my purpose on this planet is to care for the environmental side of things, like nature and wild places, and make sure that we protect them and
protect wild places, mm-hmm. plants and animals.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's prideful at all. I think it's a description for everybody of what we need to do. We can't live on this planet and pretend it's going to take care of itself. We've been doing that for far too long, and we're making a mess of it right now, and there's mm-hmm. lots of big problems. Mm-hmm. When would you say you felt that? Can you remember, you remembered eating cherries in your stroller. Can you remember, was it around that time that you also had this feeling, or was it later on that something came upon you?
Mm-hmm. I feel like this has always been there as well. Remember when I was really little, and I was in, I think, grade 3 maybe, and they came at my schoolyard, and we were sitting inside, and they was wanted to chop down the oak trees around because they were a little hollow inside of them. But oak trees can stand for hundreds of years, 500 years hollow, and that they become fantastic habitats.
Havens, yeah. Yes.
So I remember sitting there, seeing them coming with chainsaws outside, and I felt, I can't stay in this classroom. I just don't want to be here. I need to be out there with the trees and tell these people so that they know, so they can learn, you know, that these trees are very important. So it took my teachers all effort to keep me in the classroom. And as soon as, like, the bell rang, like, I was out there, like, standing, you know, I was very small. I was very skinny, very... and I would stand there next to the people with the chainsaws and say, "What do you think you're doing?" And they had to answer to me what I was, you know, because I thought, you know, this is my school, and who are you, and why are you cutting down my trees? So that just seemed like natural. And I would get, you know, I would get my friends at school to sign a petition. I made a petition so that everybody would sign the names so that they wouldn't chop down the trees. They still did.
Was it? No, it's it reminds me of the intentional community called Findhorn, which mm-hmm. was built,
it's beautiful.
You're aware of it. And Dorothy McLean, who was mm-hmm. one of the three people who founded it, was able to sense messages from plants and animals. And often she sensed pain on their part, distress, as they saw their habitat being, you know, destroyed or altered. But you did have a teacher in school who was also influential in another way. He suggested to you that you could go afar. You could leave Sweden and you could travel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. When did your traveling start? How old
so,
are
yeah,
you? Like,
I don't think he realized just like how much I would take that to heart. So he said, okay, well, after high school, it was in high school, and I was studying filmmaking like as you know, my kind of topic of, you know, I thought that I wanted to be a filmmaker. And he said, you know, before you go, because I was planning on going to university. And he said, before you go to university, if I could live my life differently, I would have taken one year off to go travel.
1 year.
So I thought, that sounds really reasonable and very smart. So I thought, yeah, that's what I'm going to do too. So I took not just 1 year off. 12 years later, I found myself still traveling and having had the most wonderful adventures and learning so much.
You bought a Eurail pass.
Yeah, that was how it started. I started traveling around Europe on a train. But then that led to getting employed on boats, and that led to, like, you know, working.
So
it just led to one thing to another.
How did it lead? Would you just walk up to somebody with a boat and the harbor, say, "Do you want anybody to come along and act as a crew for you?"
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Having done a few things like that myself, it's a wonderful way to find out new things about the world and about yourself that you never knew.
And I'll be open too. Like if you're, you know, and like if someone comes and they have this idea, they've seen what you're doing, or they met you in one, you know, way, and they might think, "Oh, you know, I'm doing this really cool thing. I thought maybe you'd interested." And I think when we're in our regular life, we're so booked up, we're so planned, our schedule's so planned that there's no room mm-hmm. for that saying, "Yes, sounds cool, let's try it." But when you're traveling and you don't have that schedule, you can just go, "Okay, I'll try it."
And when you're young and you're technically unemployed, you don't have a sort of career laid out for you, you can sort of...
You can do whatever you want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
sailboats.
Yeah.
You have a particular fondness for sailboats.
I love...
I'm revealing a secret to the audience here.
I love wooden sailboats, especially like old wooden sailboats. And it's interesting, like the job that I got, so I'd never really sailed much. I didn't really know how to sail. And I got...
You lived in central Sweden, so...
No, I lived on the west coast of Sweden, so Gothenburg. So there's a lot of sailing going on. There's some fantastic sailing, but, you know, I didn't have, you know, the funds to have a sailboat. Mm. I had sailed a few times, but not. I didn't know what I was doing. But I got on this boat, and I was doing a class just one day. And so we were sailing this little boat, and the instructor thought, with absolute complete novices, he decided, let's put the spinnaker up. No one knew what they're doing. The spinnaker went overboard, tangled up with the propeller. We had no steerage. We're going straight for shore. And so I said to him, hey, do you want me to jump overboard and try to tug it off the propeller so we can have so we can steer? And he's like, oh, you would do that? I'm like, yeah, I could give it a try. So he was
the one. You could swim, let us presume.
So I was tugging at that thing and we got it loose. So when I got back on board, he said, I'm sailing in a race this weekend in a small little boat. Would you like to be one of the crew? And I said, well, I don't really know what I'm doing. He said, well, you have the right attitude.
You did one good thing.
We can teach you. The rest can be taught. So I got to be on that. And then we won that race. So then we got to, you know, have this, like, you know, this thing. And then this friend of mine that he came up to me afterwards, he said, I didn't realize you know how to sail. And he's like, if you know how to sail and you want to sail, I got this job. He says, it doesn't pay very well. But the job is that you get to sail this 1924 wooden ship all around the Mediterranean on all the classic regatta sails. The owners put you up in a hotel.
Now, you can't salivate when you're thinking about going sailing, but something equivalent must have happened.
And this boat is beautiful. It's like an iconic classic boat. I said, what, you're going to pay me? That's what I said. So, yeah. And he's like, yeah, the pay is not great, but we put you up in a hotel. We feed you like all the meals. And I'm just like, well, yeah. Of course.
I'm very happy.
So that was so fun. So I did that for...
How long did that trip last for?
So that was like, I think 5 months or so.
Oh, my goodness.
And then after that, the boat was going over, like getting shipped to the Caribbean. And so they laid off all the crew because there was only the captain stayed on. So I got another boat job in the Caribbean and ended up meeting that boat later in the Caribbean.
So would you like me back?
They did, but then I already had another job. Yeah. But yeah, I would have liked to go back on
it. So went to Caribbean, what kind of a boat did you find?
So in the Caribbean, I got a job as a chef on a boat. And I didn't even know how to cook.
You put your hand up at the right time and you became that's how you become the chef. Remind listeners that I'm talking in a very enjoyable conversation with Michaela Cannon, expert forager and field botanist and the author of the new book, Foraging as a Way of Life.
I think we got off topic a bit.
That was all topics are on. All topics are on. Well, we've covered two oceans, the Mediterranean the Caribbean, but you also experienced the Atlantic, the Pacific. Mm-hmm. What kind of experiences and means of travel did you have there?
So I sailed across the Atlantic a couple of times on a sailboat, and that was pretty cool. There was one time we would sail, we were just coming off the coast of Africa, like just kind of across, like we're going south, we're going to the Caribbean from Europe. Mm. And it was
so flat. This was the same boat from the
Caribbean?
No, this
is a huge boat. This is a big boat. This is another one. This one was called Mirabella 3, I think.
Sailboat too?
Big sailboat, yeah. Massive sailboat.
How big?
Oh, my goodness.
60 feet?
No, bigger than that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, she was probably 300 foot. Can that be right? I don't know.
Were you the cook?
No, I was just a delivery crew. So there's big yachts need to be delivered from A to B so that the owners can get on. And then the crew needs a break once in a while, right? So they get on delivery crew, and that's like the best job ever. You get to just sail with a bunch of friends and have like fun. But this day, the ocean was absolutely clear. It was flat as a pancake, and there was dolphins everywhere. So they put the boat in neutral, and they said, if you guys want to swim, we're putting like a little line back, you know, the boat is still going, like we still are on the sail. So we're not, you know, we're not stopping. So you have to kind of swim with the boat, but we're not going very fast. If you want to swim, you can hop in. So I thought, oh, this will be a wonderful opportunity. So I jumped in, everybody's swimming in, everybody got out. And I could see this kind of fin, like something coming up. So I thought, what is that? I want to stay and see what that is. So I'm... I can feel.
You obviously hadn't watched the movie Jaws.
I had watched the movie Jaws, and that crossed my mind a bit. But then I'm like, well, if there's dolphins in the water, then there's no sharks. In my mind, that was like my reasoning. I don't think that's actually true. I think it's just a myth. But anyway, I could see this. It wasn't really a fin. It was more, yeah, it was kind of like, I don't know what it was. So I wanted to stay in the water and see what it was. And then I see everybody that had come up onto the bridge on the boat, and they're looking down on me, and I could see everybody's like jaws opening and eyes are wide as saucers. And I said, what is it? And they're like, oh my God. And I could feel this like darkness underneath me. And I said, it's under me, isn't it? And they said, yes, it is. And I'm like, what is it? They're like, it's a big whale. So this whale was right underneath me, and it turned and it looked up at me. And
you saw the eye.
I didn't see the eye. I could just feel like the people below, like above me, could see it like turning and looking at me. And then it came up a little bit like away from me, and then it went sprouted up. And I was just, so excited. It was so fun.
People talk about experiences like that with whales, and it's often life-changing.
Yeah, it came, like it was kind of going a different route, and then it saw me and it came by like and went under. And I didn't realize just how big it was. Like, it was so massive. And afterwards, when I got back, people were like, what, are you crazy? Like, why are you staying in the water? Like, I'm like, well, it
was
beautiful.
Most whales are baleen whales. They don't eat sperm whales and killer whales are the exceptions, but they're not out in the middle of the ocean. Yeah. So I think, actually, you were correct and you judged it right. It was probably perfectly safe. And the whale probably had a really good experience too, which is important.
It was wonderful. Like, yeah, just having that sense of that darkness underneath, it was really quite something.
Now, everywhere you went, you've described this in a number of ways, a number of places, you would look to see what kind of plants were growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So obviously, when you're out in the ocean, there aren't as many plants growing. But so, how did you pursue your fascination and your connection with plants when you were traveling by sail? You'd land somewhere and you'd get out of the sailboat, and what would you do?
Yeah. So the first thing I would do is I would get a field guide, and it's kind of been
field guides has been a theme for your life.
Yes, all the time. So I'd get a field guide, and often you can find the ones that are kind of a compendium of animals, plants, bugs, and, you know, everything in them. I love those because then I can tick up and be a complete nerd about anything and everything I saw. And then I would often get just the flora, just on its own. And if there was one that told you how you could use the plants, even better. So I would always carry around like a ton of books, like
a library? Or you'd buy them?
I would buy them when I traveled, because then I would take them with you. Yeah, I need to make little notes in them.
You didn't want to keep them overdue because you'd be gone for 5 months.
Yeah. So yeah, I need to make notes, and you know, they get really scuffed up, and they get, you know, my field guides look
used.
Yes, very well loved. Yeah.
and you would read obviously about quite different landscapes and quite different biota. You know, all the plants and animals would be quite different. How did that affect you, seeing all these quite different ecosystems and immersing yourself in them?
Well, I think like the running theme of those were just recognizing how beautifully they are together. You know, like this ecosystem works together in harmony with all the animals and the plants within it. It's different than this ecosystem, but they have that in common, that there's, you know, this dance and this beauty about it, and just wanting to learn more about how I can like contribute to that. Because like humans, we're a species as any other species. We just happen to be a bit of a pest species, but we don't have to be. You know, we could live. We could be part of that. We could be woven into that ecosystem and be a beneficial species, right?
And one part of that misapprehension that some are good and some are bad is that we tend to protect the ones that we think are good, which are usually the ones we like to eat play with, and we ignore the ones that are not. And I've seen many examples of that, of an ecosystem where one part of it is protected and the rest is not, or an ecosystem where there's nothing in it that's being officially protected, and so it's vulnerable to any kind of predation, usually human predation. Libraries, too, have become, that's where a lot of stuff is found. Did you end up hanging out in libraries ever?
Yeah. Whenever I can go to a library, I just love them. I have a funny story about like how I'm teaching my kids. So we went to the library, and there was this little boy there, and he was getting, he was getting a library book, and he had two library books, and he said, okay, I've got my two library books. Can I get another one, Mom? And his mom said, no, you're only allowed two. And my daughter turned to him and said, no, actually, here you're allowed 100 books at a time. And the mom,
is it true?
Yeah, it is true. So, and we have actually exceeded the 100
books
taken out at one point, especially during COVID. We would just get so many books out. And so that's why both my kids have their own library card and I have a library card.
And you have a large truck, a pickup truck to take them home. Right.
So, I just love having books everywhere and I can find that information in a tactile sense and look it up. And I like having... So I can know like where to reference, because the libraries are really great to help you find information.
Let's talk a little bit about the physical book that you have written. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's called Foraging as a Way of Life. But the title, and your mother had a big role in helping you to lay it out and typeset and all the rest of it. It's got brackets around as a way of life. Mm-hmm. What are the brackets for?
Well, that's my publisher put that there.
You were forced upon you.
No. I liked it. When I saw it, they gave me a bunch of different ideas on the front page. And I really liked this one. I thought it was really vibrant, really popping. And I liked the small font. I thought it looked really cute.
Yes.
And, and that as a way of life just kind of held,
Sure.
Like, I thought that was cool. I liked how they did that.
It's quite eye-catching, because instead of having a straight title in one mm-hmm. font, you have this little add-on. Now, your mother really worked hard on this book for a number of years.
Yeah, 9 years.
What was that like having your mom? She moved to Canada in stages when each of your two daughters was born. She would come to help with the first, and then she went back, and then she came and helped with the second, and now she's here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank goodness. Yeah, so she worked on the book. Like she asked me 1 year what I wanted for my birthday, and I said, I don't want any things, Mom, but if you could help me a little bit with this this project that I'm working on.
Did she know what, when you say a little bit, it really meant?
No, she didn't. So I just need to put a little bit of text and a little bit of, and that's what she used to do before she retired, and some photos together. Would you help me with that? And she said, sure. But I don't think she realized that it was like a 9-year project.
It was a trap.
So she's read the book more than anyone on the planet.
She probably has.
And yeah, she did a great job. Yeah.
Now, one library that was important in particular in your life, you were in the town of Karratha, which is on the western coast of Australia. And I looked it up. It's the coastal home of the Ngarluma people, who call the name Karratha means good country. But the entire landscape has been taken on by the petrochemical industry, and their destructive influences have been quite manifest. And now, of the entire population that's been there for tens of thousands of years, there's only like a handful who actually speak their language, which is a story that we'll be talking about a bit further in terms of Indigenous people in this country. Somebody likes what they've got and they come along and take it and don't say, can we? They just take it. And that's brings to mind a term that was coined by an Australian environmental philosopher, Glenn Albrecht. He talks about solastalgia. Solastalgia is a term to describe the feeling you have when your home has been so wrecked and altered, typically by industrial processes, not always, but often, that you feel homesick even when you're at home. And it's a very poignant term. And I'm sure you, even though that wasn't your home, seeing all this ravaged land must have been, because of your connection with plants, must have been kind of traumatic.
Yeah, you know what? I was pretty depressed when I was there. That kind of sadness when you see, when I see like pictures of the oil sands, or I see pictures of destruction, there is like a pain and a hurt inside. There's a deep grief. And people talk about eco-anxiety.
Do you wake up at night sometimes with that on your mind?
Yeah. Like
good,
all the
because
time.
So do I.
And my kids do too. And I don't really wish that upon them. But but as soon as you know that things are being destroyed, as soon as you know that species are going extinct every day, you cannot unknow that, right? And that weighs on you heavily. So yeah, while I was in Karatha,
you went to the library.
I went to the library because I'd be out early in the mornings, and I'd go in through the dunes and I would watch snakes and I would look at the plants, and then it would get so hot and I would just like, okay, I need a reprieve. I went to the library and I started learning about, I just wanted to learn about the indigenous people, the Aboriginal people of Australia while I was there. And I came across this book talking about something a way of learning, like a doctrine, I guess, called ethnobotany, which is plants and what people do with plants.
Yes.
And it was like a light came on inside. I'm like, yes, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Yes.
This is the name of my job.
I'm like, I never knew this even existed, but this describes exactly everything that I want to do, like plants and people, like fantastic. So then the more I learned about ethnobotany, the more I came across the name Nancy Turner. So then I'm like, okay, well, who is this Nancy Turner? She's written so many things. She's done so many great things. So I started researching her and I thought, well, you know, I'd like to meet this person. I'd like to learn from her. So I found out, okay, well, she lives in Victoria, or like she teaches in Victoria at UVic. And I thought, when I'm done here in Australia, I had like another year or so left in my visa. When I'm finished in Australia, I'm going to go and I'm going to try and study under her.
Now let's
so that
talk,
was my plan.
Let's talk about Peter, because he's he has a role in the Australian saga.
Yeah, so I met
on the other side of the country.
So I met my husband Peter while I was traveling in Australia, and he's from Canada. He's from Vernon. So he was traveling. I was working as a ranger on a little park ranger at this little resort where we had little animals that were injured, and we were teaching people about like wild species because they couldn't be re-released. So we would just show people the wild plants. So he came up to this, and he got a job as a chef there at the resort. And we met, and we fell in love. It didn't take very long.
Now, you told me a funny story. You said to him, this is the I said to him, and he said to me, you said, I have a feeling you're my soulmate. And he said, well, really, I thought it was my motorcycle that was my soulmate.
Yeah, what can you do with a guy like that, right?
You've got to marry him and straighten him up.
So we hit it off, and we decided we're going to travel on his motorbike, around Australia. And then I said, you know what? When I'm done here in Australia, I'm going to go to Vancouver Island, to Victoria. And he said, that's what I had planned to do as well. And so he had also planned that before meeting.
So he wasn't making this up.
I don't know. Maybe he was making it up. You know, I'm going to ask him when I get home.
It starts with V, Victoria, Vernon. You got away with it.
Yeah. So we were actually heading the same way. So it was a really easy transition. We didn't have to make any compromises. So.
Just remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Michaela Cannon, expert forager and field botanist and the author of Foraging as a Way of Life. So you came to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you come in a sailboat, or did you come in an airplane, or did you paddle?
Peter, he's a musician. So his band was going on tour across Canada. So it so happened that we landed in Toronto in an airplane. And then they had planned this across Canada musical tour. And Peter had been gone from the band for, a year. But he just jumped right back in. So I got to be like the tour mascot in this like really stinky van. Yeah. And they were traveling around.
You
and
were the groupie, paid groupie.
Yeah, and they were playing music at all these venues. And it was really fun. And,
what kind of music?
So they kind of play like rock and roll and... Yeah.
Cover music?
No, they write their own music. Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. So he was touring with this guy, his matey, Anishinaabe. Is that right?
Anishinaabe.
Mm-hmm. His band is Lucid 44, and he's played some fantastic music. Mm-hmm. If you get a chance to listen to him, he's got some really like amazing songs. So yeah, it was really neat to...
So you got a front seat.
Yes. So I got a front seat, and it was really fun to see... what that life was like.
And you get to know all the songs by the time you hit Victoria.
Yeah, I get to know the guys.
So in Victoria, you were going to study with Nancy Turner, but there was a slight hiccup in that process.
Yeah, she had retired like a year before I got there. So I missed her by a year or two. So then I thought, okay.
Did you meet her though?
I never met her then. I never got to meet her.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So... But I kept reading her books, and they've been really influential. And I feel like her voice has been with me for so many years. And I finally got to meet her this summer, and I got to spend some time with her. And she's just as lovely as thought.
She is. Yes. Close friend of Mary Thomas.
Yeah.
And her role with Mary in terms of restoring wild plants to the delta of the Salmon River in this town has been very significant. Mm-hmm. And her connection and Mary's, their link together, has been really quite a spectacular relationship over the years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Peter's father had passed away, mm-hmm. and you were going to help
yeah.
his mom.
So we were going to stay in Victoria, and then his mom needed help because, yeah, Peter's dad passed away. So we came up to Vernon, and we were able to find a beautiful farm to live on. We had friends of Peter's dad said, well, I need people to farm, and we were looking for somewhere to farm. So that worked out really well, and we're still on the same property.
And so what kind of property is it? Describe it a little bit.
Yeah, so it's the homestead of, like, the guy, his name is Robert Bixby, and he grew up there. So his parents had it. So it's been in his family since, you know, for like more than 100 years. And so it's forested. Most of it is forested. And then there's some open land that
How many acres is it?
It's 90 acres.
9 acres?
90.
Oh, my yeah. goodness gracious. So you've got a lot of acreage too.
So there's a lot of roaming land. And there's bears that live there.
I would hope so.
There used to be elk roaming through. Yeah. And we have bobcats. And all kinds of interesting stuff.
It's their
stuff.
Country.
Yeah, exactly.
Most of it's wild, mm-hmm. but you have a garden.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting juxtaposition, mm-hmm. you know, cultivated plants and wild plants. What do you, in your own mind, how do you see the relationship between the plants that we have selected and bred and then cultivated and the plants that our Mother Nature has mm-hmm. developed on her own?
I'm smirking a little bit now because if someone saw my garden, they wouldn't say that any of it was cultivated. It's a bit of a jungle and it's all wild. And my husband actually makes a lot of fun of me because he makes these beautiful garden boxes and then I let the weeds come in because I like eating them. And then he's like, I didn't make these garden boxes for you so
it's
that you can, you know, grow.
Rutabagas in there.
Exactly. So for me, I don't see it as a difference. Like I feel, you know, how the First Nations people here, the Suquamish people have cultivated the land in a way that they didn't cut everything down and plant one monocrop.
They worked with nature.
They worked with it and they planted some of the plants that they enjoyed having in amongst the wild plants in a way that all of it, like nothing was, it wasn't detrimental to any of them. Mm-hmm. They all worked together. Mm-hmm. And if we could only learn to be that clever, like we have stand a better chance of protecting ourselves against pest problems
food.
And we have food security and we'll have a variety of food. Like we need to learn from indigenous knowledge because we have been like Western civilization. When I say we, I mean Western civilization. We have been so sure that we have all the answers and no one else has any knowledge to contribute that we haven't even looked at, you know, even like the idea of having lawns. That's an, you know, European British concept that works really well.
Royalty.
Just showing that I have all this land. I can flaunt that. I don't need to do anything yeah. with it. And this was in an area where there was a lot of rain. And then we're trying to recreate it here. Are we idiots? Like, why are we doing that?
You know, sometimes we are idiots.
Yes.
I shouldn't say that
because I was told by my friend, he's 5. Michaela, you shouldn't call people idiots. So I'm sorry, Nathan, I take that back.
Sometimes collective wisdom is wrong.
Yeah.
In other words, it's right off base. Now, in Nancy Turner's foreword to your book, she has a lot to say about your connection to Indigenous culture. And you are very explicit, and I'll quote you, and you can tell me if I've got it right, because you wrote this, I vow to learn as much as I can from the Squamic and Silks culture. I vow to show respect and take the time to learn about the culture and the language from the people of this land.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that a lot of people are starting to realize we should all be saying
mm-hmm.
because they hold out a hand to us, as they always have,
mm-hmm.
to help us get off our mm-hmm. craziness, which is sometimes destructive craziness.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that vow, because that's a vow in English means mm-hmm. something pretty serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this is in a similar way to like how, you know, my purpose on the planet is to care for wild places and animals and plants. Like this is so tied together, like being learning to be respectful and learning from the people who have been here since time immemorial. It's all connected. And they are so generous in their sharing of knowledge, and they're so generous in all ways of life. And I feel like really humbled when I get a chance to learn from any of the elders or knowledge keepers. And I feel, you know, so blessed that they want to share, you know, anything with me after what they have experienced from white people, and that they still are willing to reach out and connect. It's to me is very inspiring to see. And the splashing community, especially, I work like, a portion of the sales from my book will go to the Tzimek Sultan, which is the splashing Tzimek Sultan, like learning for, you know, teaching the culture and the language. And I think, you know, we need to, we are at a stage in our civilization now where we're going to doom ourselves if we don't learn and change our ways.
Indeed.
And I think one of the ways that we can learn and become better here is to learn from indigenous people. So I feel like it's a matter of survival to.
And I would say that perspective that you've just outlined is more and more widely spread among people in the what we call here the settler community, the people who've come, the colonial imported people. And when people say, you know, my ancestors have been here for multiple generations, and it's like five generations, and then you think what the indigenous person next to them is thinking when you say that, when, mm-hmm. well, we've got maybe 350 generations. Mm-hmm. So it's very much rooted in the landscape. Now, you have two young daughters. How old are your daughters now?
10 and almost 8, yeah.
And you said something about the fact that children need to know. What you said was it is more important than ever to ensure that children grow up with access to natural spaces.
Mm-hmm.
What is the value of that, that as you understand it?
Mm-hmm. Like I noticed, I was reading some stories about that some kids, they had done a study, and the kids recognized more logos of businesses than they recognized different plants.
Yeah, I know about that study. It's ridiculous.
And that's really scary, because that means that your mind is just used by this corporation to make money, rather than you recognizing your area around you. And if you don't know the plants around you, you don't know what's going on. When something gets missing or something gets harmed, you won't even notice.
There was a similar study done with odors and smells.
Mm-hmm.
And children and adults could identify smells like diesel fuel and disinfectant better than they could identify the perfume from roses and lavender.
Well, that makes me so sad.
Well, it is. We should all be sad about that.
Yeah.
Because it is a tragic mm-hmm. turn of events, and it's a sign of how far off base we've got. Now, you've also, like so many people, finally recognized the importance of climate and mm-hmm. how climate changing is altering the landscape and the plants and animals living in it. And the speed of change is really quite challenging for many plants and animals to adapt to. And mm-hmm. there's a bunch of cedar trees in a little park called Coyote Park near where I live. And the young ones, the little ones, most of them have died because they need water and they don't get enough. The big ones are sort of struggling along. But you've been involved in a specific organization called the Armstrong Spalmaschine Climate Action mm-hmm. Group. What's going on there, and what are you seeing as important there?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we were formed when the big heat dome and the smoke, and we just gathered a bunch of us in the park and just thought, what can we do? And then from there on, we've petitioned and gone and done presentations for the different councils, both Armstrong, Spalmaschine, and Enderby. Right now, what we're working on is we're trying to create a repair cafe in Armstrong together with the Armstrong Library. And I'm actually, right after I meet you, I'm going to go meet the people who do the repair cafe here in Salmon Arm to get some ideas. And
yes, I've met them, and they're enthusiastic.
Yeah. So, you know, and also kind of change like perspective. You know, like we don't need new stuff. We don't need to buy a bunch of stuff. There's so much stuff out there. We can just treasure what we have, and mm-hmm. we don't need to keep up with, you know, the Joneses. Like I feel that's a little madness of just like constantly trying to get more and new stuff. And, you know, landfill gets filled. The Armstrong landfill is actually at capacity. So now they're transporting our garbage to another town.
You had something suitably critical to say about fast fashion.
Yes.
In one of your blogs. And I think it's something we all have to start thinking about. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you if you'd come back and we could talk about your book and how it's laid out. Of course, I know you don't want to talk about your book, but we'll force you to talk about it. But I think it's a fascinating book, and maybe have some plants and you can talk about specific plants. It's really been a delightful experience having you here in the studio, Michaela, and we'll look forward to having you back again. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure. See you next time.